Chapter 4. The Pattern Groans.
"What is it?"
Perrin asked, trying to ignore the sharp scent of rotting meat. He couldn't see any corpses, but by his nose the ground should be littered with them. He stood with an advance group at the side of the Johanna Road, looking northward across a rolling plain with few trees. The grass was brown and yellow, as in other places, but it grew darker farther away from the road, as if infected with some disease.
"I've seen this before," Sionard said.
The diminutive, pale-skinned Aes Sedai stooped at the edge of the road, turning the leaf of a small weed over in her fingers. She wore green wool, fine but unornamented, her only jewelry, her great serpent ring. Thunder rumbled softly above. Six wise ones stood behind Sionid, arms folded, faces unreadable. Perrin hadn't considered telling the wise ones, or their two Aes Sedai apprentices, to stay behind. He was probably lucky they let him accompany them.
"Yes," Navarin said, bracelets clattering as she knelt and took the leaf from Sionid. "I visited the Blight once as a girl. My father felt it important for me to see. This looks like what I saw there."
Perrin had been to the Blight only once, but the look of those dark specks was indeed distinctive. A red jay fluttered down to one of the distant trees and began picking at branches and leaves, but found nothing of interest, and took wing again. The disturbing thing was, the plants here seemed better than many they'd passed along the way. Covered with spots, but alive, even thriving.
"Light," Perrin thought, taking the leaf as Navarin handed it to him. It smelled of decay. "What kind of world is it where the Blight is the good alternative?"
"Mori circled the entire patch," Navarin said, nodding to a maiden standing nearby. "It grows darker near the center. She could not see what was there."
Perrin nudged Steyr down off the road. Fail followed. She didn't smell the least bit afraid, though Perrin's Two Rivers armsmen hesitated.
"Lord Perrin?" Will called.
"It's probably not dangerous," Perrin said. "Animals still move in and out of it."
The Blight was dangerous because of what lived there, and if those beasts had somehow come southward, they needed to know. The Aiel strode after him without a comment. And since Fail had joined them, Berylaine had to as well, Anura and Galen trailing her. Blessedly, Aleandra had agreed to remain behind, in charge of the camp and refugees while Perrin was away. The horses were already skittish, and the surroundings didn't help their moods any. Perrin breathed through his mouth to dampen the stench of rotten death. The ground was wet here, too. If only those clouds would pass so they could get some good sunlight to dry the soil. And the horses' footing was treacherous, so they took their time. Most of the meadow was covered in grass, clover, and small weeds, and the farther they rode, the more pervasive the dark spots became. Within minutes, many of the plants were more brown than they were green or yellow. Eventually, they came to a small dale, nestled amid three hillsides. Perrin pulled Steyr to a halt. The others bunched up around him. There was a strange village here. The buildings were huts built from an odd type of wood, like large reeds, and the roofs were thatch, but thatch built from enormous leaves, as wide as two man's palms. There were no plants here, only a very sandy soil. Perrin slid free of the saddle and stooped down to feel it, rubbing the gritty stuff between his fingers. He looked at the others. They smelled confused. He cautiously led Steyr forward into the center of the village. The Blight was radiating from this point, but the village itself showed no touch of it. Maidens scattered forward, veils in place, Sulin at their head. They did a quick inspection of the huts, signing to one another with quick gestures, then returned.
"Nobody?"
Fail asked.
"No,"
Sulin said,
cautiously lowering her veil.
This place is deserted.
Who would build a village like this?
Perrin asked.
In Gildon, of all places.
It wasn't built here, Missouri said.
Perrin turned toward the slender Aes Sedai.
This village is not native to this area, Missouri said. The wood is unlike anything I've seen before.
The pattern groans, Berylaine said softly. The dead walking, the odd deaths. In cities, rooms vanish and food spoils.
Perrin scratched his chin, remembering a day when his axe had tried to kill him. If entire villages were vanishing and appearing in other places, if the blight was growing out of its rifts where the pattern was fraying,
light. How bad were things becoming? Burn the village, he said, turning. Use the one power. Scour as many of the tainted plants as you can. Maybe we can keep it from spreading. We'll move the army to that camp an hour away, and we'll stay there tomorrow if you need more time.
For once, neither the Wise Ones nor the Aes Sedai voiced so much as a sniff of complaint at the direct order.
Hunt with us, brother.
Perrin found himself in the wolf dream. He vaguely remembered sitting drowsily by the dwindling light of an open lamp, a single flame shivering on its tip, waiting to hear a report from those dealing with the strange village. He had been reading a copy of the travels of Jane Farstrider that Gaul had found among the salvage from Malden. Now Perrin lay on his back in the middle of a large field with grass as tall as a man's waist. He gazed up, grass brushing his cheeks and arms as it shivered in the wind. In the sky, that same storm brewed, here as in the waking world. More violent here. Staring up at it, his vision framed by the stalks of brown and green grass and stems of wild millet, he could almost feel the storm growing closer, as if it was crawling down out of the sky to engulf him.
Young bull, come, come hunt.
The voice was that of a wolf. Perrin by instinct knew that she was called Oak Dancer, named for the way she had scampered between saplings as a whelp. There were others, too. Whisperer, Morning Light, Sparks, Boundless. A good dozen wolves called to him, some living wolves who slept, others the spirits of wolves who had died. They called to him with a mixture of scents and images and sounds. The smell of a springbuck, pocking the earth with its leaps, fallen leaves crumbling beneath running wolves, the growls of victory, the thrill of a pack running together. The invitations awakened something deep within him, the wolf he tried to keep locked away. But a wolf could not be locked up for long. It either escaped, or it died. It would not stand captivity. He longed to leap to his feet and send his joyous acceptance, losing himself in the pack. He was young bull, and he was welcome here.
No,
Perrin said, sitting up, holding his head.
I will not lose myself in you.
Hopper sat in the grass to his right. The large gray wolf regarded Perrin, golden eyes unblinking, reflecting flashes of lightning from above. The grass came up to Hopper's neck. Perrin lowered a hand from his head. The air was heavy, full of humidity, and it smelled of rain. Above the scent of the weather and that of the dry field, he could smell Hopper's patience.
You are invited, young bull,
Hopper sent.
I can't hunt with you, Perrin explained. Hopper, we spoke of this. I'm losing myself. When I go into battle, I become enraged. Like a wolf.
Like a wolf, Hopper sent. Young bull, you are a wolf. And a man. Come hunt.
I told you I can't. I will not let this consume me.
He thought of a young man with golden eyes, locked in a cage, all humanity gone from him.
His name had been Gnome. Perrin had seen him in a village called Jara.
Light, Perrin thought. That's not far from here.
Or at least not far from where his body slumbered in the real world. Jara was in Gildan. An odd coincidence.
With a Tavirin nearby, there are no coincidences.
He frowned, rising and scanning the landscape. Moraine had told Perrin there was nothing human left inside of Gnome. That was what awaited a wolf brother if he let himself be completely consumed by the wolf.
I must learn to control this, or I must banish the wolf from me, Perrin said. There is no time left for compromise, Hopper.
Hopper smelled dissatisfied. He didn't like what he called a human tendency to wish to control things.
Come, Hopper sent, standing up in the grass. Hunt.
I...
Come learn, Hopper sent, frustrated.
The last hunt comes.
Hopper's sendings included the image of a young pup making his first kill. That and a worry for the future, a normally unwolf-like attribute. The last hunt brought change. Perrin hesitated. In a previous visit to the wolf dream, Perrin had demanded that Hopper train him to master the place. Very inappropriate for a young wolf, a kind of challenge to the elder's seniority, but this was a response. Hopper had come to teach, but he would do it as a wolf taught.
I'm sorry, Perrin said. I will hunt with you, but I must not lose myself.
These things you think, Hopper sent, displeased. How can you think such images of nothing?
The response was accompanied by images of blankness, an empty sky, a den with nobody in it, a barren field.
You are young bull. You will always be young bull. How can you lose young bull? Look down and you will see his paws beneath. Bite and his teeth will kill. There is no losing this.
It is a thing of humans.
The same empty words over and over, Hopper sent.
Perrin took a deep breath, sucking in and releasing the too wet air.
Very well, he said,
hammer and knife appearing in his hands.
Let's go. You hunt game with your hooves?
An image of a bull ignoring its horns and trying to leap onto the back of a deer and stomp it to the ground.
You're right.
Perrin was suddenly holding a good Two Rivers longbow. He wasn't as good a shot as Jondan Baran or Rand, but he could hold his own. Hopper sent a bull spitting at a deer. Perrin growled, sending back a wolf's claws, shooting from its paws and striking a deer at a distance, but this only seemed to amuse Hopper further. Despite his annoyance, Perrin had to admit that it was a rather ridiculous image. The wolf sent the image to the others, causing them to howl in amusement, though most of them seemed to prefer the bull jumping up and down on the deer. Perrin growled, chasing after Hopper toward the distant woods, where the other wolves waited. As he ran, the grasses seemed to grow more dense. They held him back, like snarled forest undergrowth. Hopper soon outpaced him.
Run, young bull.
I'm trying,
Perrin sent back.
Not as you have before.
Perrin continued to push his way through the grass. This strange place, this wonderful world where wolves ran, could be intoxicating. And dangerous. Hopper had warned Perrin of that more than once.
Dangers for tomorrow. Ignore them for now,
Hopper sent, growing more distant.
Worry is for two legs.
I can't ignore my problems, Perrin thought back.
Yet you often do, Hopper sent.
It struck true, more true perhaps than the wolf knew. Perrin burst into a clearing and pulled to a halt. There, lying on the ground, were the three chunks of metal he'd forged in his earlier dream. The large lump, the size of two fists, the flattened rod, the thin rectangle.
The rectangle glowed faintly yellow-red, singeing the short grass around it. The lumps vanished immediately, though the simmering rectangle left a burned spot. Perrin looked up, searching for the wolves. Ahead of him, in the sky above the trees ahead, a large hole of blackness opened up. He could not tell how far it was away, and it seemed to dominate all he could see while being distant at the same time. Matt stood there. He was fighting against himself. A dozen different men wearing his face, all dressed in different types of fine clothing. Matt spun his spear, and never saw the shadowy figure creeping behind him, bearing a bloody knife.
"Matt!"
Perrin cried, but he knew it was meaningless. This thing he was seeing, it was some kind of dream or vision of the future. It had been some time since he'd seen one of these. He'd almost begun to think they would stop coming. He turned away, and another darkness opened in the sky. He saw sheep, suddenly, running in a flock toward the woods. Wolves chased them, and a terrible beast waited in the woods unseen. He was there in that dream, he sensed. But who was he chasing, and why? Something looked wrong with those wolves. A third darkness, to the side. Fael, Grady, Elias, Gaul all walked toward a cliff, followed by thousands of others. The vision closed. Hopper suddenly shot back through the air, landing beside Perrin, skidding to a stop. The wolf wouldn't have seen the holes. They had never appeared to his eyes. Instead, he regarded the burned patch with disdain and sent the image of Perrin, unkempt and bleary-eyed, his beard and hair untrimmed and his clothing disheveled. Perrin remembered the time. It had been during the early days of Fael's captivity. Had he really looked that bad? Light, but he had seemed ragged. Almost like a beggar. Or like Gnome.
"Stop trying to confuse me," Perrin said. "I became that way because I was dedicated to finding Fael, not because I was giving in to the wolves."
"The newest pups always blame the elders of the pack."
Hopper bounded through the grasses again. What did that mean? The sense in images confused him. Growling, Perrin charged forward, leaving the clearing and re-entering the grasses. Once again, the stalks resisted him. It was like fighting against a current. Hopper shot on ahead.
"Burn you, wait for me," Perrin yelled.
"If we wait, we lose the prey. Run, young bull."
Perrin gritted his teeth. Hopper was a speck in the distance now, almost to the trees. Perrin wanted to think on those visions, but there wasn't time. If he lost Hopper, he knew that he would not see him again this night.
"Fine," he thought with resignation.
The land lurched around him, grasses speeding by in a flash. It was as if Perrin had leaped 100 paces in one step. He stepped again, shooting forward. He left a faint blur behind him. The grasses parted for him. The wind blew in his face with a comfortable roar. That primal wolf inside of him sparked to wakefulness. Perrin reached the woods and slowed. Each step now took him a jump of only about 10 feet. The other wolves were there, and they formed up and ran with him, excited.
2 feet, young bull?" Oak Dancer asked.
She was a youthful female, her pelt so light as to be almost white, with a streak of black running along her right side. He didn't answer, though he did allow himself to run with them through the trees. What had seemed like a small stand had become an expansive forest. Perrin moved past trunks and ferns, barely feeling the ground beneath his feet. This was the way to run. Powerful, energetic. He loped over fallen logs, his jumps taking him so high that his hair brushed the bottoms of the branches. He landed smoothly. The forest was his. It belonged to him, and he understood it. His worries began to melt away. He allowed himself to accept things as they were, not as what he feared they might become. These wolves were his brothers and sisters. A running wolf in the real world was a masterwork of balance and control.
Here, where the rules of nature bent to their will, they were far more. Wolves bounded to the sides and leaped off trees, nothing holding them to the ground. Some actually took to the branches, soaring from limb to limb. It was exhilarating. Had he ever felt so alive? So much a part of the world around him, yet master of it at the same time? The rough, regal leather leaves were interspersed with yew, and the occasional ornamented spicewood in full bloom. He threw himself into the air as he passed one of these, the wind of his passing pulling a storm of crimson blossoms from the branches. They surged around him in a swirling blur, caught in the currents, cradling him in their sweet scent. The wolves began to howl. To men, one howl was like another. To Perrin, each was distinct. These were the howls of pleasure, the initiation of a hunt.
Wait. This is what I feared. I cannot let myself be trapped. I'm a man, not a wolf.
At that moment, however, he caught scent of a stag, a mighty animal, worthy prey. It had passed this way recently. Perrin tried to restrain himself, but anticipation proved too strong. He tore off down the game trail after the scent. The wolves, including Hopper, did not race ahead of him. They ran with him, their scents pleased as they let him take the lead. He was the herald, the point, the tip of the attack. The hunt roared behind him. It was as if he led the crashing waves of the ocean itself, but he was also holding them back.
I cannot make them slow for me, Perrin thought.
And then he was on all fours, his bow tossed aside and forgotten, his hands and legs becoming paws. Those behind him howled anew at the glory of it. Young Bull had truly joined them. The stag was ahead. Young Bull picked it out through the trees. It was a brilliant white, with a rack of at least 26 points. The winter felt worn away. And it was enormous, larger than a horse. The stag turned, looking sharply at the pack. It met Perrin's eyes, and he smelled its alarm. Then, with a powerful surge of its hind legs, flanks taut with muscles, the stag leaped off the trail. Young Bull howled his challenge, racing through the underbrush in pursuit. The great white stag bounded on, each leap taking it 20 paces. It never hit a branch or lost its footing, despite the treacherous forest floor coated with slick moss. Young Bull followed with precision, placing his paws where hooves had fallen just moments before, matching each stride exactly. He could hear the stag panting, could see the sweat foaming on its coat, could smell its fear. But no, Young Bull would not accept the inferior victory of running his prey to exhaustion. He would taste the blood of the throat, pumping full force from a healthy heart. He would best his prey in its prime. He began to vary his leaps, not following the stag's exact path. He needed to be ahead, not follow. The stag's scent grew more alarmed. That drove Young Bull to greater speed. The stag bolted to the right and Young Bull leaped, hitting an upright tree trunk with all four paws and pushing himself sideways to change directions. His turn gained him a fraction of a heartbeat. Soon he was bounding a single breath behind the stag, each leap bringing him within inches of its hooves. He howled, and his brothers and sisters replied from just behind. This hunt was all of them, as one. But Young Bull led. His howl became a growl of triumph as the stag turned again. The chance had come. Young Bull leaped over a log and seized the stag's neck in his jaws. He could taste the sweat, the fur, the warm blood beneath pooling around his fangs. His weight threw the stag to the ground. As they rolled, Young Bull kept his grip, forcing the stag to the forest floor, its skin laced scarlet with blood. The wolves howled in victory, and he let go for a moment, intending to bite at the front of the neck and kill. There was nothing else. The forest was gone, the howls faded. There was only the kill. The sweet kill. A form crashed into him, throwing him back into the brush. Young Bull shook his head, dazed, snarling. Another wolf had stopped him. Hopper. Why? The stag bounded to its feet
and then bounded off through the forest again. Young Bull howled in fury and rage, preparing to run after it. Again Hopper leaped, throwing his weight against Young Bull.
"If it dies here, it dies the last death," Hopper sent. "This hunt is done, Young Bull. We will hunt another time."
Young Bull nearly turned to attack Hopper. But no, he had tried that once, and it had been a mistake. He was not a wolf. He... Perrin lay on the ground, tasting blood that was not his own, exhaling deeply, his face dripping with sweat. He pushed himself to his knees, then sat down, panting, shaking from that beautiful, terrifying hunt. The other wolves sat down, but they did not speak. Hopper lay beside Perrin, setting his grizzled head on aged paws.
"That," Perrin finally said, "is what I fear." "No, you do not fear it," Hopper sent.
"You're telling me what I feel?"
"You do not smell afraid," Hopper sent.
Perrin lay back, staring up at the branches above, twigs and leaves crumpling beneath him. His heart thumped from the chase.
"I worry about it, then."
"Worry is not the same as fear," Hopper sent. "Why say one and feel the other? Worry, worry, worry. It is all that you do."
"No. I also kill. If you're going to teach me to master the wolf dream, it's going to happen like this."
"Yes."
Perrin looked to the side. The stag's blood had spilled on a dry log, darkness seeping into the wood. Learning this way would push him to the very edge of becoming a wolf. But he had been avoiding this issue for too long, making horseshoes in the forge while leaving the most difficult and demanding pieces alone, untouched. He relied on the powers of scent he'd been given, reaching out to wolves when he needed them, but otherwise he'd ignored them. You couldn't make a thing until you understood its parts. He wouldn't know how to deal with or reject the wolf inside him until he understood the wolf dream.
"Very well," Perrin said. "So be it."
Galad cantered stout through the camp. On all sides, children erected tents and dug fire pits, preparing for the night. His men marched almost until nightfall each day, then arose early in the morning. The sooner they reached Andor, the better. Those light cursed swamps were behind them. Now they traveled over open grasslands. Perhaps it would have been faster to cut east and catch one of the great highways to the north, but that wouldn't be safe. Best to stay away from the movements of the Dragon Reborn's armies and the Shan Chan. The light would shine upon the children, but more than one valiant hero had died within that light. If there was no danger of death, there could be no bravery. But Galad would rather have the light shine on him while he continued to draw breath. They had camped near the Jahanna Road and would cross it on the morrow to continue north. He had sent a patrol to watch the road. He wanted to know what kind of traffic the highway was drawing, and he was in particular need of supplies. Galad continued on his rounds through camp, accompanied by a handful of mounted attendants, ignoring the aches of his various wounds. The camp was orderly and neat. The tents were grouped by legion, then set up forming concentric rings with no straight pathways. That was intended to confuse and slow attackers. A section of the camp lay almost empty near the middle, a hole in the formation where the questioners had once set up their tents. He had ordered the questioners spread out, two assigned to each company. If the questioners were not set apart from the others, perhaps they would feel more kinship with the other children. Galad made a note to himself to draw up a new camp layout, eliminating that hole. Galad and his companions continued through the camp. He rode to be seen, and men saluted as he passed. He remembered well the words that Garth Bryn had once said. Most of the time, a general's most important function was not to make decisions, but to remind men that someone would make decisions.
My lord Captain Commander, said one of his companions, Brandel Vordarian. He was an older man, eldest of the lord's captain who served under Galad. I wish you would reconsider sending this missive. Vordarian rode directly behind Galad, with Trom on his other side. Lords Captain Gulliver and Harnish rode behind, within earshot, and Bornhold followed, acting as Galad's bodyguard for the day.
The letter must be sent, Galad said.
It seems foolhardy, my lord captain commander, Vordarian continued. Clean-shaven, with silver washing his golden hair, the Andoran was an enormous square of a man. Galad was vaguely familiar with Vordarian's family, minor nobles who had been involved in his mother's court. Only a fool refused to listen to advice from those older and wiser than himself, but only a fool took all of the advice given him.
Perhaps foolhardy, Galad replied, but it is the right thing to do.
The letter was addressed to the remaining questioners and children under the control of the Seanchan. There would be some who had not come with Asunawa. In the letter, Galad explained what had happened, and commanded them to report to him as soon as possible. It was unlikely any would come, but the others had a right to know what had happened. Lord Vordarian sighed, then made way as Harnish rode up beside Galad. The bald man scratched absently at the scar tissue where his left ear had been.
Enough about this letter, Vordarian. The way you go on about it tries my patience.
From Galad's observation, there were many things that tried the Mirandian's patience.
You have other matters you wish to discuss, I assume?
Galad nodded to a pair of children cutting logs who stopped their work to salute him.
You told Child Bornhold, Child Bayar, and others that you planned to ally us with the witches of Tarvalin.
Galad nodded.
I understand that the notion might be troubling, but if you consider, you will see that it is the only right decision.
But the witches are evil.
Perhaps, Galad said.
Once he might have denied that. But listening to the other children and considering what those at Tarvalin had done to his sister was making him think he might be too soft on the Aes Sedai.
However, Lord Harnish, if they are evil, they are insignificant when compared to the Dark One. The lost battle comes. Do you deny this?
Harnish and the others looked up at the sky. That dreary overcast had stretched for weeks now. The day before, another man had fallen to a strange illness where beetles had come from his mouth as he coughed. Their food stores were diminishing as more and more was found spoiled.
No, I do not deny it, Harnish muttered.
Then you should rejoice, Galad said, for the way is clear. We must fight at the lost battle. Our leadership there may show the way of light to many who have spurned us. But if it does not, we will fight regardless, for it is our duty. Do you deny this, Lord Captain?
Again, no. But the witches, my Lord Captain Commander?
Galad shook his head.
I can think of no way around it. We need allies. Look about you, Lord Harnish. How many children do we have? Even with recent recruits, we are under 20,000. Our fortress has been taken. We are without succor or allegiance, and the great nations of the world revile us. No, don't deny it. You know that it is true.
Galad met the eyes of those around him, and one by one they nodded.
The questioners are at fault, Harnish muttered.
Part of the blame is theirs, Galad agreed. But it is also because those who would do evil look with disgust and resentment upon those who stand for what is right.
The others nodded.
We must tread carefully, Galad said. In the past, the boldness, and perhaps over-eagerness, of the children has alienated those who should have been our allies. My mother always said that a victory of diplomacy did not come when everyone got what they wanted. That made everyone assume they'd gotten the better of her, which encouraged more extravagant demands. The trick is not to satisfy everyone, but to leave everyone feeling they reached the best possible result.
They must be satisfied enough to do as you wish, yet dissatisfied enough to know that you bested them.
And what does this have to do with us? Gulliver said from behind. We follow no queen or king.
Yes, Galad said. And that frightens monarchs. I grew up in the court of Andor. I know how my mother regarded the children. In every dealing with them, she either grew frustrated or decided that she had to suppress them absolutely. We cannot afford either reaction. The monarchs of these lands must respect us, not hate us.
Dark friends, Harnish muttered.
My mother was no dark friend, Galad said quietly. Harnish flushed.
Accepting her, of course.
You speak like a questioner, Galad said, suspecting everyone who opposes us of being a dark friend. Many of them are influenced by the shadow, but I doubt that it is conscious. That is where the hand of the light went wrong. The questioners often could not tell the difference between a hardened dark friend, a person who was being influenced by dark friends, and a person who simply disagreed with the children.
So what do we do? Vordarian asked. We bow to the whims of monarchs?
I don't yet know what to do, Galad confessed. I will think on it. The right course will come to me. We cannot become lapdogs to kings and queens. And yet, think of what we could achieve inside of a nation's boundaries if we could act without needing an entire legion to intimidate that nation's ruler. The others nodded at this, thoughtful.
My lord Captain Commander, a voice called.
Galad turned to see Bayar on his white stallion cantering toward them. The horse had belonged to Asinawa. Galad had refused it, preferring his own bay. Galad pulled his group to a halt as the gaunt-faced Bayar neared, his white tabard pristine. Bayar wasn't the most likable of men in the camp, but he had proven to be loyal. Bayar was not, however, supposed to be in the camp.
I set you watching Johanna Road, Child Bayar, Galad said firmly. That duty was not to end for a good 4 hours yet.
Bayar saluted as he pulled up.
My lord Captain Commander, we captured a suspicious group of travelers on the road. What would you have us do with them?
You captured them?
Galad asked.
I sent you word to watch the road, not take prisoners.
My lord Captain Commander, Bayar said, how are we to know the character of those passing unless we speak with them? You wanted us to watch for dark friends.
Galad sighed.
I wanted you to watch for troop movements or merchants we could approach, Child Bayar.
These dark friends have supplies, Bayar said. I think they might be merchants.
Galad sighed. Nobody could deny Bayar's dedication. He'd ridden with Galad to face Valda when it could have meant the end of his career. And yet there was such a thing as being too zealous. The thin officer looked troubled. Well, Galad's instructions hadn't been precise enough. He would have to remember that in the future, particularly with Bayar.
Peace, Galad said. You did no wrong, Child Bayar. How many of these prisoners are there?
Dozens, my lord Captain Commander.
Bayar looked relieved.
Come.
He turned his mount to lead the way. Already cook fires were springing up in the pits, the scent of burning tinder rising in the air. Galad caught slices of conversation as he rode past the soldiers. What would the Shan Chan do with those children who had remained behind? Was it really the dragon reborn who had conquered Ilion and Tyr, or some false dragon? There was talk of a gigantic stone from the sky having struck the earth far to the north in Andor, destroying an entire city and leaving a crater. The talk among the men revealed their worries. They should have understood that worry served no useful function. No one could know the weavings of the wheel. Bayar's captives turned out to be a group of people with a surprisingly large number of heavily laden carts, perhaps 100 or more. The people clustered together around their carts, regarding the children with hostility. Galad frowned, doing a quick inspection.
That's quite a caravan, Bornhold said softly at his side. Merchants? No, Galad said softly.
That's travel furniture. Notice the pegs in the sides? So they can be carried in pieces. Sacks of barley for horses. Those are farrier's tools wrapped in canvas at the back of that cart to the right. See the hammers peeking out?
Light,
Bornhold whispered. He saw it too. These were the camp followers of an army of substantial size. But where were the soldiers? Be ready to separate them, Galad told Bornhold, dismounting. He walked up to the lead cart. The man driving it had a thick figure and a ruddy face, with hair that had been arranged in a very poor attempt at hiding his increasing baldness. He nervously worked a brown felt hat in his hands, a pair of gloves tucked into the belt of his stout jacket. Galad could see no weapons on him. Beside the cart stood two others, much younger. One was a bulky, muscular type with the look of a fighter, but not a soldier, who could be some trouble. A pretty woman clutched his arm, biting her lower lip. The man in the cart gave a start upon seeing Galad.
Ah, Galad thought. So he knows enough to recognize Morgaze's stepson.
So, travelers, Galad said carefully, my man says you told him that you are merchants?
Yes, good lord, said the driver.
I know little of this area. Are you familiar with it?
Well, not much, sir,
the driver said, wringing that hat in his hands.
We are actually far from home ourselves. I am Basil Gill of Camelin. I have come south seeking business with a merchant in Ebu Dar. But these Shaun Chan invaders have left me unable to do my trade.
He seemed very nervous. At least he hadn't lied about where he was from.
And what was this merchant's name? Galad asked.
Why, Fallon de Borsha, my lord, Gill said. Are you familiar with Ebu Dar?
I have been there, Galad said calmly. This is quite a caravan you have. Interesting collection of wares.
We have heard that there are armies mobilizing here in the south, my lord. I purchased many of these supplies from a mercenary troop who was disbanding and thought I could sell them down here. Perhaps your own army has need of camp furniture? We have tents, mobile smithy equipment, everything that soldiers could use.
Clever, Galad thought. Galad might have accepted the lie, but the merchant had too many cooks, washwomen, and farriers with him, and not nearly enough guards for so valuable a caravan.
I see, Galad said. Well, it happens that I do have need of supplies, particularly food.
Alas, my lord, the man said, our food cannot be spared. Anything else I will sell, but the food I have promised by messenger to someone in Lugard.
I will pay more.
I made a promise, my good lord, the man said. I could not break it, regardless of the price.
I see,
Galad waved to Bornhold. The soldier gave commands, and children in white tabards moved forward, weapons out.
What are you doing?
Gil asked.
Separating your people, Galad said. We'll talk to each of them alone and see if their stories match. I worry that you might have been unforthcoming with us. After all, what it seems like to me is that you are the camp followers of a large army. If that is the case, then I would very much like to know whose army it is, not to mention where it is.
Gil's forehead started to sweat as Galad's soldiers efficiently separated the captives. Galad waited for a time, watching Gil. Eventually, Bornhold and Bayar came jogging up to him, hands on their swords.
My lord Captain Commander,
Bornhold said urgently. Galad turned away from Gil.
Yes?
We may have a situation here, Bornhold said.
His face was flushed with anger. Beside him, Bayar's eyes were wide, almost frenzied.
Some of the prisoners have talked. It's as you feared. A large army is nearby. They've skirmished with Aiel. Those fellows over there in the white robes are actually Aiel themselves.
And?
Bayar spat to the side.
Have you ever heard of a man called Perrin Goldeneyes?
No. Should I have?
Yes, Bornhold said. He killed my father.